Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. Keegan Coon is the co-director of the climate change documentary Cowspiracy, which raises some troubling questions about an industry that may be just too big for environmental advocates to tackle. And the City Council is considering exercising its power of eminent domain to condemn some Kaka'ako roadways. We'll hear from Representative Scott Sykes. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Bill Sage. What would you do with wood? It would depend on the wood. And Hawaii's Wood Show would be a good place to see it. And a century later, it's still for the birds. It's the centennial of the Migratory Bird Treaty.
On Tuesday, September 20th, stay here for the conversation after the news.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to The Conversation. It's Tuesday. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Bill. How are you doing?
Well, so far, so good. You know, in these uncertain times, plots abound, and there are possible dark bovine plots ahoof, or should I say afoot?
Well, that might just lead into our next story. Defenders of the environment pride themselves on their opposition to the industries and individuals that poison the planet. But is there one that's just too big to take on? That's the troubling idea advanced in the documentary Cowspiracy, whose co-director, Keegan Coon, is on the line with us now. Good morning, Keegan.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
I've just been going over the premise, the central idea of your documentary, and I think it's one that'll surprise a great many people. Could you kind of sum it up for me?
Sure. So Cowspiracy is a feature-length environmental documentary. It follows my co-director, Kip Anderson, on this journey of finding out the true impacts of animal-based diets on the planet. Mm-hmm. And during the course of the film, we find out that raising animals for food is the leading cause of rainforest destruction around the world.
Slow down a second. I'm missing part of what you're saying. Is leading cause of what?
Rainforest destruction.
Okay.
Around the world, 91% of Brazilian Amazon destruction has been associated with raising livestock.
Mm-hmm.
It's the leading cause of water consumption in the United States. 55% or more of all water consumed in the U.S. is for livestock. It's the leading cause of species extinction, water pollution, topsoil erosion, ocean dead zones, virtually any environmental ill you could care about. Animal agriculture plays a major role, if not the very top. It's also a major contributor to greenhouse gases.
Well, obviously, Keegan, we're a meat-eating nation, and there's a lot riding on animal agriculture, isn't there?
Absolutely. I mean, the United States has one of the largest meat-consuming pounds per capita in the world. So we're absolutely a country that eats a lot of meat. And the impacts to our environment, both local, nationally, and globally, are very clear. And that's the shocking part about it and why the film's called Cowspiracy, is that you would expect this information to be readily available from all the large environmental organizations. But sadly, it takes a backseat, if not mentioned at all, by large environmental organizations.
Environmental organizations are never hesitant to take on, say, energy industries, other sources of pollution and environmental degradation. What are you saying about animal agriculture, that they're just too big to take on?
You know, it's an interesting thing. It's something that we really explore in the film. There's a lot of different reasons why I think some of these organizations aren't talking about it. One could be the political ramifications. If you look back in the 90s, Oprah Winfrey and Howard Lyman, a former cattle rancher, were sued by a group of Texas cattlemen for speaking out against the health implications of eating beef. And I think that's really sent a shockwave through our society that you can't speak ill against this industry without fear of, you know, legal repercussions. There's also the fact that, as you pointed out, we are very much a meat-centric society. And so to speak about changing our diets could be uncomfortable for a lot of people and potentially even the board members of these organizations themselves.
But they're in the business of making those guys uncomfortable. And other industries have fought back, energy industries, others have fought back against these environmental challenges routinely and using the same tactics, right? Outspending them, taking them to court, wearing them down. Am I right?
Yeah, that is true. Again, but when we talk about changing lifestyle habits, like driving more fuel-efficient cars or changing our light bulbs to compact fluorescents, those don't invoke the same sort of emotional reactions that we get when we talk about, for example, reducing or eliminating animal products from our diet. There is something rather shocking to people when we talk about changing our diet for the greater good. But there is also political ramifications as well. In the United States, we have laws like ag gag laws that make it a criminal offense.
What laws?
Ag gag laws. They've been nicknamed ag gag laws, but they're heralded as food security laws. And what they do, they exist in about 13 states in the U.S., and they make it illegal to document the abuses being committed against animals and the environment on farms without the written permission of the farm owners themselves. We also have federal laws like the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, which the law pretty clearly reads anyone who disrupts the business of an animal enterprise and any business that uses animals for profit, to disrupt that business is to be committing an act of terrorism, which is rather draconian if you really think about it. So
sure.
There's those political ramifications as well.
Somebody's got a pretty powerful lobby, obviously, but but they're not the only ones. That's what I'm saying. Why this distinction between animal agriculture and other, perceived threats to the environment?
Absolutely. And that's really what the film is focused on. It's not only the impacts of this industry, but to look at deeper, why is it? And so we go into a lot of detail. I don't want to give away too much of the film.
But you can answer that question, right, Keegan?
Yeah. What, I'm sorry, say that again?
You can answer that question. I mean, that doesn't take away from your film to answer that question. So why?
I think a big part of it is that these organizations, the people who run these organizations, eat meat themselves. When we went to the organizations to film interviews, oftentimes we would show up about lunchtime and they'd be taking their orders for their carne asada burritos with an organization that's supposed to be protecting the rainforest. Well, how could you talk ill against and encourage people to eat less meat if you yourself are eating meat and your entire board is eating it? I think that's the biggest thing, is that it's a cultural hurdle that is different from changing other lifestyle changes.
Well, Keegan, you've described it as a cultural hurdle and a political hurdle, but it's an economic force, of a practically unparalleled economic force. Isn't that what this is about, the sheer economic power of animal agriculture?
I think absolutely that plays a role. Some organizations do accept money. World Wildlife Fund, for example, has worked with the livestock industry and takes money from these organizations, from these companies. So I think that plays a role as well. But, it's this interesting thing because people will bring that up. Well, if we stopped, for example, producing oil out of the ground, we would lose all these jobs. And if we stopped eating as much meat or gave up meat entirely, we would lose all these jobs and the economic value of this industry. But the truth is that new technologies come along all the time that displace entire industries. And we adapt, we change. And we can look at world economies, how they adapt and change to new technologies and new lifestyles. I think that's exactly what we'll see. And what's really required of us if we want to live in a sustainable planet.
So, obviously, a cultural shift, a consciousness shift, is assuming any of these things and knowing how long it takes for that kind of real plate shift in a culture. Is it too late?
That's a great question. There's a study that just came out from the University of Illinois and Climate Healers that looked at, if we were to take all the world's grasslands that were formerly forest, but that are now cleared of forest to make room for raised livestock, grass-fed livestock, if we allow those forests to come back by removing the livestock, we'd be able to sequester 265 gigatons of carbon from the atmosphere, which is more carbon than we've emitted since the entire industrial era began. So we literally would be able to stop and reverse all the negative impacts of burning fossil fuels over the last 200-plus years, simply by removing grass-fed livestock and allowing this force to come back. So in that respect, no, it's not too late. We really do have an option to halt climate change. But on other aspects, we are too late. We're in the largest mass extinction the planet has seen in 65 million years. More species are going extinct now than almost any other time in history. And the major driver of that is from clearing forests and habitat to make room for livestock and agricultural products that are fed to livestock. So we can't get those species back, but we can slow it down, absolutely. And so it's not too late, and it's something that absolutely will need to happen if we want to live on a livable planet.
Well, Keegan, as I'm sure you know, Hawaii is pretty much the extinction capital of the world in terms of species lost, species endangered. This is the place to be bringing your message. Thanks very much for talking with us this morning.
Thank you. If people are interested in coming to see me speak, I'll be in Honolulu this weekend at the Veg Fest Oahu at Honolulu Hale.
I know. Keegan Kuhn is a documentary filmmaker and the co-director of the environmental film Cowspiracy, The Sustainability Secret. He'll be headlining Hawaii's first Veg Fest on Saturday, September 24th, at Honolulu Hale. And this is The Conversation on statewide member support at HPR2. It's 8:16 and coming up, good wood. But first, birds in the backyard.
Today we're at a higher elevation backyard in an unincorporated rural area along the Hamakua coast on the island of Hawaii. We're traveling along the old Mamalohoa Highway to traverse this agriculturally zoned land, and along the way we've seen small-scale agriculture, farming, orchards, and livestock. On either sides of the winding highway, windbreaks are interspersed amongst houses, trees, and pasture. Rainwater tanks are also noticeable from the highway, although most adjacent residences have electricity, water, and telephone service. Extremely high rainfall and cloud cover is typical daily weather here. In the late 19th and early 20th century, this area was allocated to families of sugarcane workers as farm homesteads and remains largely so today. In the 1970s, many countercultural families from Oahu and the mainland moved into the area, bringing their values and ideas of the Back to the Land movement. This backyard differs from many other parts of Hawaii Island in that it was never used for either cattle ranching or sugarcane plantations. Can you name this community? And do you know what the name means? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets the T-shirt.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Honolulu Chamber Music Series, presenting the string trio Time for Three, playing their arrangements of classical, jazz, pop, and folk music, 7:30 p.m. September 27th at University of Hawaii's Orvis Auditorium, honoluluchambermusicseries.org.
I think that I shall never see a poem as lovely as a tree. But if the poem is not that good, behold what artists do with wood. Hawaii's Wood Show, Nala'au o Hawaii, is the Hawaii Forest Industry Association, that's the HFIA's, annual juried woodworking show. And it's on through October 2nd at the Honolulu Museum of Art School Gallery at Linikola. UH Professor Emeritus, author, teacher, artist, and wood show judge Dwayne Preble joins us in studio this morning. Dwayne, aloha.
Good morning.
You authored the book Art Forms, now in its 11th edition and a standard for visual arts in over 300 colleges, so I think I'd be fair in assuming that you have a pretty good idea for what's good. But aesthetically, be it wood, be it any other visual art, what's the starting point for you?
Well, I start with the sense of beauty, which I think most people have.
Mm-hmm.
The sense of beauty, I think we pick up from the fact that we are nature ourselves, and that when we look at other aspects of nature, we really enjoy what we see, you know, whether it's a beautiful human person or a beautiful tree or a flower or a sunset or whatever.
Most people just have that innate aesthetic appeal, I mean, a sense of what is appealing and then what is not.
I think it gets pretty covered over as we grow up. A lot of times children have a really fine sense of it when they're in preschool and do some paintings and drawings and things. You get a sense of energy and excitement about seeing the world and translating it into art. But we get overwhelmed by all kinds of other stuff that's crashing around in our perceptions and our brains.
Well, in Hawaii, with all the wonderful wood forms, both endemic species of trees and the woods that have been introduced but now thrive here, do you find when you judge pieces, for the example in the wood show, as an example of a visual art that's also really tactile and tangible, do you see that many of the pieces that stand out for you, somebody intuitively saw the artwork within the piece and went from there, and you relate to that?
Yes, I think so. I think that's where a lot of the woodworkers begin. They look at a log, they look at a chunk of wood, and, you know, they see what's possible in it. So in many cases, they actually select from the tree what they want, you know, particularly if a tree is cut down and, mm-hmm. and available, dried properly, and so on. That wood itself is a wonderful experience in terms of how people respond to wood. I think it's warmth, it's colors, it's because it's a living thing, you still see some of the life of the wood as it, even when it's no longer living in the tree. It's a very vital kind of exciting material to work with, but it has a lot of character of its own, so people have to really pay attention to grain and all the different strengths of given woods. Each wood has its own character, and the character needs to be part of the piece of the woodwork that you know we now see exhibited.
In the show that's coming up now and is running now, when you were judging, did you find any particular piece that just suddenly made you gasp when you saw it for the first time, or does the aesthetic appreciation go like that in your mind?
Well, the range in the show is incredible. I mean, there's everything from beautiful, simple calabash that has great curvature and great simplicity by David Chung, and there are pieces that are extremely elaborate. You know, like there's a piece called the Tansu Screen by Robert Butts that's just amazing. I mean, it must have taken him over a year to do it, at least, you know, maybe 2 years. I mean, it's just the numbers of, you know, he's used many different kinds of wood in creating these surfaces. And
the idea, too, when you get the incredible intricacies that some of these people can turn out with it, do you find... in techniques, a lot of them use all hands-on or machine tools coming away, like some of the Dremel burrs and things, almost dental engine size, to get ultra-fine detail.
Yes, it's amazing how much, how the woodworking technology has increased and makes it in some ways easier.
Mm-hmm.
And you can, you know, just simple things like turning a bowl is not that simple when you're working with some of the forms that they're doing. I think it's a very exciting show, and it starts, one of the things that really is foundational is the fact that we rely on forests for our water, for our the beauty of our mountains, and it says a lot about Hawaii, both traditionally and in terms of what's been added on. And I think many people are in Hawaii are very tuned in to that, and also tuned into the conservation aspect of saving forests.
When you were a child, what was your first work of art? What really grabbed you and suddenly went, I want to do this, and I'm going to, and I can, and I did?
I think it didn't start by looking at art as much as just enjoying drawing. I think most preschool children enjoy just scribbling around on paper, if they have paper, and drawing materials, crayons, markers, whatever. easels with paint brushes is also a good thing for kids, but a lot of kids don't get any help from their parents in the sense that parents will give kids coloring books or something like that, which kind of is not an adequate way to turn a kid on in the beginning. They need to just have the opportunity to have ready access to materials on their level, you know, down at their height, so they can start just scribbling, and that's where it begins, and that's where it began for me.
I'm glad it began that way, and I'm glad it's going to continue, because you seem to be one of these people who has the aesthetic sense and inspiration to get everybody else to go, hey, I either appreciate that or I can do that. I want to thank you so much for being in the program this morning, Duane, and the art show with wood is absolutely beautiful. Thank you.
And I was only one of three jurors. So.
One of three, but still, a tree in the forest makes an aesthetic sound. Thank you so much, Duane.
You're welcome.
University of Hawaii Professor Emeritus, artist, author, teacher Duane Preble, and one of three judges for the Wood Show, Nala'au Hawaii at Lini Kona, Honolulu Museum of Art School Gallery, now through the 2nd of October. Hours are 10 to 5, Tuesday through Sunday, free admission. We got all the details on our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation.
They're called sustaining members for a reason. These are the listeners who know that their monthly gifts mean a steady and predictable income for the station, one that allows this listener-supported operation to survive. Sustainers are a big part of the reason HPR can provide two program streams a day, all day, every day. Your pledge of $10 a month will keep your public radio station strong, and we hope you'll consider becoming an HPR sustainer. Call us at 955-8821 or set up your monthly support at hawaiipublicradio.org. A controversy that has simmered for years over the treatment of crew members aboard international fishing vessels has come home to Hawaii, forcing the local industry to address a worldwide human rights issue and a direct threat to its viability. Civil Beat editor Patty Epler looks at the Hawaii Longline Association's response. Good morning, Patty.
Good morning, Chris.
You know, we've been hearing this as on an international fund for quite a number of years, allegations of near slavery conditions, no recourse for the members of the crews. What brought this home?
Well, actually, it's been sort of an open secret here in Hawaii as well. There have been news reports about this exact issue of foreign fishermen sort of being held captive on boats, mm-hmm. not allowed to get off even when they can't, when they need medical care, for quite a few years. So the Associated Press, of course, has been looking at the international sort of human slavery, human trafficking angle, and then did a breakout piece here on Hawaii, and that's what's getting all the attention now. But in reality, it's actually been known here for a long time, so we might ask, why is it just now that the fishing industry is stepping up to try and deal with it?
Exactly. That was certainly what came to my mind in reading this, because it is an open secret, and is it because all of a sudden it's hitting the industry quite directly in its pocketbook?
Well, my cynical self would think that what's happening is that now the congressional delegation is stepping in and demanding an investigation, and it's gotten so much attention from the AP coverage that the fishing industry here locally is sort of trying to get out in front of it, maybe, and try and stave off what could be sort of more draconian type regulation and restrictions on them. But what they've done now is they've formed a task force just in the last few days. And these are the folks that control the fish auction, you know, down at Pier 38, mm-hmm. which is where most of the fish comes in. And so they are now going to require that before you can unload your tuna or your swordfish for sale, you have to have a signed contract. You have to show proper paperwork for these fishermen, including passports. So we'll see how that goes.
Passports seems, you know, it seems likely that there's going to be a real bump in the supply, because I would be surprised if every vessel were able to meet those requirements.
It is interesting to see how that's going to work. They've hired a couple of experts, a woman named Katrina Nakamura, who actually has a very good reputation as being someone who knows about human trafficking and slavery issues. And she is working through some requirements for better working conditions on the boats themselves. The federal Border Protection Agency, Customs and Border Protection, has been meeting with the fishermen without the boat owners and the captains around to talk with them about the conditions in recent days. So it seems like there is progress being made, but it'll be interesting to see what it does to the supply of ahi.
It sure will. And, of course, that's going to hit some people where they live. This is a story that isn't likely to go away, is it, Patty?
No, not at all. And in fact, we're doing some more relatively deep dive looks at how some of these exemptions that they operate under came into play, and just some different things that relate to the federal investigation into this. So I'm sure we'll have more to talk about as the days go on.
Well, thanks very much, Patty.
Thank you, Chris. I appreciate it.
You bet. Patty Epler is editor and general manager of Civil Beat and editor-in-chief of HuffPost Hawaii.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Ferraro Choi, providing environmentally sustainable architecture, interior design, and research for projects throughout Hawaii and the Pacific. FerraroChoi.com.
Land in Kaka'ako is at a premium more these days than ever, and a long-standing issue over who owns what in a section of streets that a local business says it owns is coming to a head. The city council is voting today on an effort to reclaim the land parcel under question through eminent domain. It's in Representative Scott Sykes' district. He's part of a task force that has been working to resolve the dispute, and he's on the phone with us this morning. Good morning, Representative.
Hey, good morning, Chris. Thanks for having me today.
This is if I understand this situation, Scott, it means that I could park on a Kaka'ako street and have my car towed and ticketed by a private entity. Is that right?
Right. There's a company that beginning a few years ago started to block off lanes and create private parking stalls on several roads in Kaka'ako. And, you know, my concern is that it's gotten to the point where it has created a public safety issue for pedestrians and vehicles in the area. And as you know, Kaka'ako is being rapidly redeveloped, and we need to make sure that road ownership, which is, I think, is a basic issue, needs that it be clarified.
Yeah, the irony here is in an area of rapid development, you have an area that's physically deteriorating because, as I understand it, the city is not maintaining the roads since it doesn't own them, right?
Right. The city took the position a couple of years ago that it would stop maintaining these roads that, you know, are purportedly owned by this private company. So, the roads have not been maintained. Curbs, potholes, drainage have become issues in these areas.
Not exactly the image that a revived Kaka'ako wants to present, is it?
Exactly. I believe that all of the landowners, all of the developers should be very concerned about this road ownership issue, because it will ultimately begin to impact not just the residents who live on these roads, but it's going to impact everyone who's using Kaka'ako.
Well, how did it, Scott, how did it come about in the first place? I mean, it's the idea of somebody in the middle of a very busy area of a busy city owning parking space, I'm trying to get my head around this.
Right. Well, what happened was the Kakaako Land Company in 1985 approached a woman who was the granddaughter of the original owner of these roads. And in 1985, they convinced her that she owned these roads and that she should convey them to Kakaako Land Company. So she signed a quitclaim deed, and it's based it's on the basis of this quitclaim deed that Kakaako Land Company claims to own these roads, and that's why they were able to create these private parking stalls.
Could that happen somewhere else? Has that happened in other places?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure to what extent it's happened elsewhere and under these circumstances. But quitclaim deeds are, you know, are used. Usually, family members will use quitclaim deeds to transfer property from one family member to another because it's kind of an easy way mm-hmm. to do that. Mm-hmm. But a quitclaim deed does not provide any guarantee that the person who is transferring the land owns the land and has the legal authority to transfer the land. So it's kind of under a cloud.
Yeah. Yeah, because the whole thing of owning a roadway is another issue. I mean, is it or is it not part of Honolulu?
Right. And the other point, you know, that I would want to make is that the original owner of this land, somebody who owned it in the late 1800s, actually dedicated the roads to the territory of Hawaii in 1903. And the territorial legislature passed a resolution to accept those roads. And this is all in 1903. A deed was not recorded to mark the transfer. But, you know, I believe that in the owner's mind, the roads had been dedicated. And that's why in 1985, the granddaughter of this person didn't realize that she owned the roads.
Mm-hmm. The remedy now being looked at is eminent domain.
And right.
I'm not sure, you know, John Q. Citizen completely, including myself, entirely understands that. What's the justification for eminent domain?
Well, in this situation, you know, there's a public purpose for the city to acquire the roads, not just to clear title, but to also ensure that ensure public safety in this area. And, you know, eminent domain or condemnation to me is kind of a last resort.
Yeah.
The public has gone through great lengths on its own to try to resolve this. Small business owners fought a lawsuit a few years ago, which is still pending, to challenge Kakaako Land Company. In the past year, a condominium association hired its own attorney to enforce its property rights because Kakaako Land Company was encroaching onto its property line. So the public has really expended a lot of money and effort to try to fix this.
Mm-hmm.
And it's time for the city and the state to take action and to help the general public. You know, the other thing that happened was in the past legislative session, the legislature passed House Bill 2604, which seeks to clarify title to these roads. And the Attorney General is reviewing that law right now to see how it can be implemented.
It does. It really does seem like an area where clarification is eminently called for, wouldn't you say? I mean, because, you know, it would really be quite a precedent if similar things were to sort of erupt in other areas.
Exactly. And I think what you have here is a situation where the ownership claim is very, very weak because of the circumstances. You know, the use of a quitclaim deed, the dedication in 1903. I mean, there are so many questions about what happened here. And it's really up to government. It's up to the city and the state to help to work to resolve this. You can't just put it back on the public and ask the public to keep filing lawsuits or to keep hiring attorneys to resolve this. It's really a government responsibility at this point.
You know, what I find troubling, Scott, is that as what you describe and would certainly seem to fit the description of a weak ownership claim can cause this much trouble.
Exactly. And I think that it's important for the city and the state to take action on this, because you don't want this happening or to be reoccurring in other areas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you think the eminent domain vote is going to go through?
I have no idea. I think it will probably depend on what the testimony looks like today at the city council hearing. But, I'm pretty sure that the council is well aware of the growing concerns on this issue. So I'm hopeful that they will advance this resolution.
Well, Representative Psyche, thank you very much for talking with us about this. Appreciate it.
All right. Thanks, Chris.
You bet.
Okay.
Scott Psyche is a representative for State House District 26, which includes the McCully, Kaheka, Kaka'ako, and downtown districts of Honolulu.
I'm Tad Bit Nasty, or Sylvia Flores, from Pacific Roller Derby. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Helping people.
It made me feel good.
Taking care of.
It's just something that you
want
to do.
I wanted to help.
Hi, everyone. This is Bob Wehrman. It's time for The Benevolent Mind, our quest to discover the spark that ignites giving. There's an expression, you get back more than you give. Well, here's a great example. A tsunami struck Kauai in 1946. It killed 14 and obliterated the small towns of Haena and Wainiha. Residents were left destitute. All the bridges were destroyed. The injured could not get out and help could not be brought in. An Oahu man named Bull Haynes was particularly moved by the plight of these people. So he and a friend organized a relief effort, filled a barge with supplies, and took them to the disaster zone. Some families in Haena were so grateful they offered land to Bull. He was overwhelmed, but he said, "No, I can't take it, but I'll buy it from you." So they sold it to him for about $400. After this, Bull went on with his life and all but forgot about the land. Years later, he asked his son Jimmy to see if it was worth anything. Well, the land was worth about $500,000, so they sold it. Half the proceeds went to support Bull for the rest of his life. Because he worked long ago to help so many, he lived out his final years without financial worry. Our program is a production of Hawaii Public Radio and is sponsored by the Hawaii Community Foundation, believing for 100 years that philanthropy is all about you.
Today we went exploring in a backyard on Hawaii Island with an elevation of 2,500 feet along the lush, rural Hamakua coast. From this backyard, we enjoyed the views of the summit of Mauna Kea above and the Pacific Ocean below. We asked you if you could name this community, if you knew what its name meant. There's no record of Native Hawaiian settlement in this present-day community, although Native Hawaiians likely visited the area to take resources from the Ohialihuahapu'u Native Forest, but did not live there, as wet forest was not considered a desirable place to live. The original native forest was cleared and replaced by a patchwork of pasture, farms, and windbreaks. The first settled inhabitants of the area were families of Japanese and Portuguese heritage, and many of the present residents are descended from those families. Many of today's families pursue farming, small-scale agriculture, growing orchards, and raising livestock. Then and now, a typical day of weather is cloudy and rainy. The name of this Big Island Hamakua Coast backyard is believed to mean either long mound or long cloud in the Hawaiian language. The name of this unincorporated rural area is Ahualoa. And nobody got that today, so that much more for opportunities tomorrow. At 8:48, that's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from the College of Business at Hawaii Pacific University, whose MBA Flex Plus program offers a blend of classroom and online classes to fit the lives of working professionals. hpu.edu/business.
Thank you.
The Migratory Bird Treaty was signed on August 16th, 100 years ago. So how have our peripatetic avian friends fared in the past century, and what lies ahead for them? Our next guest joined the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in 1991, working in Honolulu and remote islands, including Midway. She spent the last quarter century in bird conservation, spanning all levels of the service from the Hawaii area to Washington, D.C., and currently she's chief of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's Pacific Region Migratory Birds and Habitat Program based out of Portland, Oregon, from where she joins us this morning by phone, and she is Nanette Sito. Aloha, Nanette.
Aloha, Bill. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. So with the centennial of bird conservation behind, we have another century lying ahead for these wonderful migratory critters. As I understand, it was signed on behalf of Great Britain because Canada then was sort of part of the Dominion?
Yes, that's correct.
So now we have the birds that were covered. It's, what, over 100 species?
Well, actually, there's over 1,000 species of migratory birds that are protected under the Migratory Bird Treaty, because we did have three other treaties, a total of four total, mm-hmm. With Japan, Russia, and Mexico in addition to Canada.
So they were all sort of combined together and sort of used in force as one, in a sense?
Yes, we have the individual agreements with the countries, but in the U.S., we have the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, which overarches the protection of all the bird species that are shared with those four countries.
Mm-hmm. Now, I noticed that when the treaties were signed, essentially it was hunters and ladies' hats for feathers that were really decimating so many of the populations. But as times and fashions change, it looks like it's more what we thought were green energy and power consumption that could be one of the main hazards. How is this affecting treaties as it's ongoing in the next century?
Well, the treaties do allow the different governments to work together to come up with strategies and best management practice that we can work with the different industries as well as other uses that may have effects on migratory bird populations. So it's an agreement between the countries to really work together to conserve and protect migratory birds.
I know that here in the U.S., recently there was quite a kerfuffle about Duke Energy and a senator from South Carolina introducing riders on several bills to try to back off the degree of penalties for accidentally killing birds. What has become of that? Do you know?
I don't know that specific issue in particular, the details, but I had heard of it, mm-hmm. and I believe it did not move forward.
Yeah, I believe the President Obama said if anything got to his desk, they would attempt to veto it, but apparently they've been trying to keep adding riders here and there, which almost would seem to gut the strong provisions because money has very large teeth when people are endangering. But I guess one of the things you would probably cover, I know that wind farms seem to be a large potential for helping green energy get off the oil addiction. But my one question is, with these giant blades and turbines, what sort of protection can you offer migratory birds who seem to fly into these paths?
Well, we do work with the industry to develop some strategies for them to implement during their operations so that mm-hmm. they can reduce the number of potential hazards that they can cause for migratory birds.
Right. Do you have any other specific, I mean, do you put up, are there actual ways of warning the birds that they're flying into a wind turbine area? How would this be accomplished? Have they given you any concrete proposals?
There's actually been some research done where they've been looking at whether some type of devices, whether it be cameras or radar detectors, will be able to detect when large flocks of birds fly through the area where the wind turbines are. Mm-hmm. And there's actually a mechanism that potentially could shut down or slow down the spinning of the turbines, the blades.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Those are all experimental. There's different experiments on the painting of the blades. There's definitely areas where they've been looking at ways to reduce potential collisions with the turbines.
And how about power lines? Apparently, when it's one or two birds, it's really not a problem. But I think the problem arises when you have large flocks. The birds close together, especially if it's raining or very humid, could almost act as conductors and arc the gaps and kill masses at once. Is that one of the problems?
There actually has been some great techniques developed where it can be implemented on the way the power lines are constructed to really mm-hmm. reduce the electrocution of birds on the power lines. And And there's guidelines that we provide to the industry, and many of the industry folks implement those, and we have reduced those numbers dramatically over the years.
Well, that's good news to hear. Now, as for yourself, you were Hawaii-born and raised, correct?
Yes,
and
I was.
But now your Kuleana extends for all the Pacific, and it's based in Portland.
That's right.
So as you're up there, are there any specific birds that fly from the Oregon area to Hawaii?
There are some migrating birds. There's some shorebirds that actually do fly from Alaska and parts of the West Coast, such as the Pacific golden plover. We don't really actually see them much here in the Oregon, but definitely in Alaska, and they migrate down to spend their winters in Hawaii. We do have albatrosses that definitely fly throughout the West Coast and Alaska, that they forage out on the wide Pacific Ocean, but they breed on the small islands in the northwestern Hawaiian islands and actually some on Oahu and Kauai as well.
You know how kids love birds and dinosaurs. I wonder if many of the kids realize that what we call birds are really the dinosaurs that made it. Is that sort of education been allowed to sort of promulgate through the service?
Yeah, I think so. It's definitely a good history of the evolution of birds, and we certainly have many environmental education programs that the Fish and Wildlife Service is involved in.
Yes, I remember there was a wonderful book called The Dinosaur Heresies. It, apparently there was a large ash cloud that wiped out a flock, or I should say a herd, of apatosaurs, and they were so well preserved from the ash cloud, they noticed the organ outlines. And guess what? Those giant dinosaurs had crops and gizzards.
Right.
And apparently dinosaurs were warm-blooded, and today a lot of them still have feathers, and we call them birds.
That's right.
And I want to thank you very much for being with us this morning and protecting these wonderful flying dinosaurs that we call birds today.
Well, thank you so much, Bill, for having me.
You're welcome, Nanette. Nanette Seto is chief of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's Pacific Region Migratory Birds and Habitat in Portland. For more information on the Migratory Bird Treaty Centennial, see our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation.
Support for The Conversation comes from Bank of Hawaii Private Banking, where a personal relationship manager and financial services team provide custom solutions. Learn more about Bank of Hawaii Private Banking at boh.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
So if we had a herd of cows in Kaka'ako, could we condemn them for what they're doing to the area?
Well, up to this very moment, Bill, I hadn't thought about that.
What about birds landing?
Well, I'm still sort of revolving around the idea of birds as dinosaurs that made it. I like that.
Yeah, they're actually there, and it's a wonderful book, The Dinosaur Heresy.
Yeah, I'll look for that. That looks good. And that's it for today. And up tomorrow, we're going to be reminding you that you can't vote if you don't register. And we'll be talking about the upcoming National Voter Registration Day with Marsha Rose Joyner.
We'd like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave us your comments. Here's the number, 808-792-8217. Also, email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post your comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation or BKOZHPR.
And you can find our past shows in podcast form on the Conversation page, along with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under Talk Shows for The Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
I'm Bill Sage.
And I'm Chris Vandergood. Meet us tomorrow morning for more of The Conversation.